Welcome to Conversations with David Lewis. Today, the United States of Jihad. Today, continuing my conversation with CNN terrorism analyst Peter Bergen. He was the very first person to produce a TV interview with Osama bin Laden in a cave in Afghanistan in 1997. He has written multiple books on the subject. His latest is United States of Jihad, Investigating America's Homegrown Terrorists. I should also say that Peter and I were colleagues at both CNN and ABC News and have been friends for more than 30 years. Well, what scares you the most, Peter?
I mean, terrorism is not, you know, anybody listening to this conversation, there's an infinitesimal chance that you'll be killed by a terrorist. Americans are 3,000 to 5,000 times more likely to be killed by a fellow American wielding a gun than they are to be killed by a terrorist in the United States. That says quite a lot about kind of the state of gun violence in this country, which is really much more of a serious public health and national security problem than terrorism at this point. I mean, we've kind of put up a lot of defenses that have made it very hard for terrorists to get into this country and hard for them to carry out acts of terrorism. If we'd had this conversation, David, in 2002, and we said that there were, in the next decade and a half, 45 Americans would be killed by jihadi terrorists in the United States, that would have seemed like an absurdly optimistic prediction, but that's actually what's happened. And so, you know, the government, whether it has done a pretty good job of protecting us in all sorts of ways, and which is why the threat really is not from terrorists coming from without, it is people radicalized from within. Luckily, there is a kind of natural ceiling to what a lone wolf or a pair of lone wolves can do. We saw that in Boston with the 4 deaths there. We saw that in San Bernardino with the 14 deaths there. We saw that in Fort Hood with the 13 deaths there, all of which were conducted by either a pair or a lone or one lone wolf. So, you know, in terms of what worries me, I think that, you know, we've done a pretty good job of managing, containing this problem. Yet Americans remain quite, you know, very concerned about it. And, you know, perhaps that says something about the nature of terrorism. It's designed to terrify. It's not a rational fear in the sense that the statistical likelihood is very low, but the fact that they can strike anywhere at any time, for instance, at a Christmas office party in San Bernardino in December where 14 people were killed, kind of adds to the kind of fear that people have. But the fact is that this is a problem which has been largely managed and contained, but by the law of averages, it's jihadi terrorists radicalized in this country will occasionally get one through, and that's just an unfortunate fact of life. But it will be nothing on the scale of Paris, where 130 people died in November, or certainly on the scale of 9/11.
You actually do a little bit of comparing of right-wing terrorism in the U.S. and deaths caused to it as compared to sort of Islamic terrorism. Events like what happened in, you know, Charleston, South Carolina. What are the numbers? What are the comparisons?
Well, I mean, we compiled a database of right-wing terrorists, fanatical right-wing extremists conducting terrorist attacks, which are, you know, attacks against civilians for political purposes. And you mentioned Charleston. Nine people that died there. Dylan Roof, the perpetrator, said he was trying to start a race war, which is a fundamentally political objective. So we calculate there were about 48 deaths since 9/11, which is about the same number as the 45 jihadi terrorist attacks. And 48 is probably an undercount because some of these stories don't get the national attention that a jihadist terrorist attack would get. But so certainly this is a threat, and the United States government is keenly aware of that. The FBI is. I mean, these fanatical right-wing extremist types, they're violent, they kill police officers, they're very anti-government, they can be dangerous.
I asked what scared you the most. You're as wired into national security types in Washington, defense, intelligence, law enforcement, as anyone. What scares them the most?
Well, they're paid to be worry about these things. So, I mean, some of the things that they worry about, I think, are less plausible than, terrorist arms with nuclear weapons is, I think, highly unlikely. I mean, I would say that some of the more plausible scenario is, recall the anthrax attack, David, after 9/11, killed five people. It was conducted by a microbiologist who was one of the top microbiologists in the U.S. government. His rationale for all of this was highly idiosyncratic. But imagine a microbiologist who suddenly, you know, who is actually adopts jihadi terrorist ideas or some other, you know, anti-American idea. It could be some other form of ideology. You know, imagine if Ted Kaczynski, the Unabomber, had been, skilled microbiologist. So I think, you know, I think it's a reasonable thing to be concerned that there might be some kind of biological terrorist attack conducted by somebody who understands biology and quite well. And there is a sort of Moore's law in biology right now where things that were kind of unimaginable 20 years ago are, a lot easier to do. So I think that is something to be concerned about.
You're pretty critical in the book of some of the measures that the U.S. has taken to, quote, protect itself from terrorism. And you go after the NSA for some of their sweeping violations, perhaps, of American privacy. Talk to me about that.
Yeah. Well, you know, the NSA phone metadata program, basically the government harvested every American's phone metadata, which is not the content of the phone calls, but who you called and when and for how long. And of course, that's all pretty useful if the information gets in the wrong hands, you know, which doctor you have, who your closest associates are. And the phone, I mean, I think there are two objections. One is the Fourth Amendment is the Fourth Amendment, and this was done without warrants and was just a sort of basically a huge fishing expedition. And the second thing is that it didn't really yield anything of much interest. It certainly didn't stop any terrorist attacks. The one case the government can point to is a case in San Diego where somebody sent $8,500 to a Somali terrorist organization, but that's the sum total of taking everybody's phone metadata. That's pretty thin pickings.
At what cost?
Public.
Yeah.
What's
that? At what cost socially, but also dollars.
Well, that's an interesting question. I actually don't know how expensive this was, but now we have a much more reasonable approach, which is that phone companies will keep the phone metadata for a shorter period of time than 5 years. The government will need a warrant to get into that phone data, and that's entirely reasonable. But of course, none of this would have become public without the Edward Snowden revelations. Interestingly, and then there's been certainly overkill by the FBI. I portray in the book a schizophrenic bipolar kid from Arizona who moved to California, who basically had the mind of a child and was highly suggestible. And he gets roped into a supposed plot to attack a bank in California. And but for his bad luck about getting embroiled with an FBI informant and undercover officer, he should have really been in a group home getting medication. And I use that case because I think it's a pretty clear case where it may not rise to a legal defense of being entrapped, because the FBI is always pretty careful to say, do you really want to go through with this? But it certainly feels wrong when you are directing a lot of resources at somebody who's bipolar and schizophrenic, when really, this person didn't pose a threat. Except in the context of a sting operation.
Peter, if you were appointed by President Trump as head of all anti-terrorism efforts, or President Clinton, shall we say, how would you change how the budget to fight terrorism is divided? What would you do? What would you stop doing? And where would you move things around?
Well, I think one thing that certainly Trump has suggested is we should ban all Muslim immigration, and one of the findings of my book is that the people with the most useful information are about a potential terrorist plot are peers and family members, and so the last thing you want to do is alienate that group. You want to basically bring them in as somebody that who might do the right thing, and in fact we've seen a number of family members dropping a dime. There was two Somali fathers in Colorado last year noticed that three of their teenage daughters were missing, and they went to the FBI. It turned out that their daughters were on the way to join ISIS, and they were arrested at Frankfurt Airport and sent back. We want to encourage that. That's the best approach to dealing with this problem, is to sort of have somebody inform authorities in some fashion before something gets very serious. So, I mean, you know, that's a completely cost-free exercise, by the way. There's no budget involved. It's a sort of a way of thinking about the problem. It's with the people that we want to enlist Muslim Americans who are, you know, in the main keenly aware that this is an issue that is, you know, that they need to deal with, rather than alienating them.
I guess I'm asking, you know, let me ask it more directly. Where are we spending money badly on anti-terrorism efforts?
Well, I mean, we're spending a lot of money on anti-terrorism efforts. You know, the intelligence budget, a lot of which is concerned about terrorism, has gone from $26 billion to $80 billion in the last decade and a half. You know, it's an interesting question because... you know, I don't really have a ready answer. I know that we're spending a lot of money. You know, it's hard to assess exactly, you know, what's a waste of time and what isn't. I mean, there's, you know, the one of the reasons that, you know, there is probably a lot of redundancy in the system and some overkill, but one of the reasons that we have had such a relatively small number of deaths as a result of jihadi terrorism since 9/11 is precisely because the government has spent a lot of money on this, and there isn't any discussion either on the Republican or the Democrat side to, you know, to kind of reduce the counterterrorism budget. That's just off the table because Americans have made it very clear that they have zero tolerance for some kind of mass casualty attack. And politically, you know, I think it would be very damaging for any candidate to advocate this or even do this, even if there is some money that probably, I mean, just in the nature of things, there's always money you can save.
Well, Peter Bergen, thank you, as always. Any final thoughts on this book, which, listeners, is United States of Jihad, Investigating America's Homegrown Terrorists. What should listeners be thinking about? What should they be looking for, Peter?
Well, I mean, there's a big puzzle about why would an American citizen a decade and a half after 9/11 join a group like ISIS? And I, you know, that's a big puzzle, and I try and answer some of that in the book. And then, you know, the other part, if somebody who'd read the book said the message he took away was kind of relax. You know, this problem is not as big as, you know, many people perceive it to be.
So the lesson is, you know, don't harsh my mellow?
Indeed. I'll pretend to understand what that means. Is that a sort of 1960s thing?
No, you have to kind of have a Bob Marley. Don't be harsh in my mellow, man. Peter Bergen, Peter Bergen, as always, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, David.
My guest has been Peter Bergen, CNN's terrorism analyst, the first person to produce a TV interview with Osama bin Laden back in 1997. He's written four books on terrorism. His latest book is United States of Jihad, Investigating America's Homegrown Terrorists.